Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
What mark do people leave on the places they inhabit, and how do those places shape people in turn? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Those are some of the questions that came to mind for me over and over looking through the photographs on display in a collection of works by Laura Wilson. Collected on many trips through the western United States and northern Mexico over the course of four decades, these are images of people and things separated from mainstream culture by things like poverty, ethnicity, religion, geography, or accomplishment. The exhibition That Day, Laura Wilson, is on view at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art through February 14th of next year, and Laura Wilson joins us now to talk about how she made those images and what they mean to her. Laura, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's very, very nice to be here. I'm glad to see you again.
You too. You've said before that the power of the camera is based on reality, but you have never defined yourself as a journalist.
Well, I don't know that that's conscious, because I think, like a journalist, I'm going out into the world and looking for stories and looking for those things which may resonate with people. And I hope that I'm able to make pictures that are strong enough, moving enough, complex enough that people will be interested in them.
You go to some places where surely no one has seen a professional photographer poking around wanting to follow their every move. Are those the times when you just leave your camera in the car for a matter of minutes or hours or days?
I always try and have my camera around my neck. I work with a Nikon generally, and so I strap it around my neck and have it hanging from me. Because if you leave it in the car, which of course is understandable, I always feel I may miss that one picture that would have been an important one to take. So I try to always carry it with me.
Does a photograph make the moment that it is taken somehow more important than the one that happened just before or the one that happens just after?
I think that's the magic of photography, that exactly that happens, that the moment in which the shutter is released, and that it's the decisive moment, as Cartier-Bresson said. And it really, sometimes it's all that you remember about a life, for instance, is the moment that the shutter was clicked and that person is forever captured on a sheet of paper or in an image. And it may be your only record of the person, or even if there are other aspects of a person's life, the voice, the sound, the actual existence of the person, it's the photograph often that defines how we remember the person, think of the person, even people who are still living.
And by their nature, photographs are always about the past. They can only be about the past.
That's exactly right. And it's one of the things that I find so miraculous about photography, that it really is, I mean, for me, it's a way to stave off loss of family, loss of aspects of the environment, loss of experiences that one might have with a group of people. And with a photograph, it's, you can hold it close, you can keep it next to you in a way that you might not just by remembering it.
So when did you realize that you were interested in people who were somehow isolated from the broader world? Was that a pattern that emerged for you over time, or did you begin your career as a photographer thinking, this is where I'll go with this?
I think the first time I was aware that I was really deeply interested in people removed from the world was when I went in the 1990s to Montana, and I had the opportunity to see the communities of Hutterites that live in Montana. And they're very successful communities of farmers and ranchers. And they're in Montana, and they're up in Saskatchewan and Alberta. And they live on big farms and ranches, completely communally, but they don't allow photography. And so I had a very difficult time. There, Chris, I did leave the camera in the car. And I did have to make a number of trips to several Hutterite colonies before I was able to take the camera out and actually take a picture. But I that's when I realized, after spending a lot of time with the Hutterites, what one of the things that interested me about them was that they were completely removed and enclosed in their own communities, their own way of life, their own spirituality and work life and family life.
Is there something about that that appeals to you, even though I don't think you have any intention to go live in an isolated community somewhere? Could you imagine that life for yourself or some version of it?
I think that in many ways, communities are isolated. I mean, it happens that the Hutterites are geographically isolated from mainstream America, but there are other communities. For instance, I've spent a lot of time on movie sets, and those are enclosed worlds, and yet they may be filming right in the heart of Los Angeles or in Rome. But they're enclosed, and they're removed from real life, what we think of as real life. And so I, in fact, am drawn to these enclosed worlds, and even ranching, which has interested me over many years. Not just anyone can drop in on a ranch. You have to know someone. And so I think, yes, I am particularly drawn to those people from enclosed worlds.
There are a lot of great ranch photographs. There's one in the book that you have of the Y6 Ranch, and it's the women of the ranch. It's three generations, some little girls and a young mother and a grandmother. And there's a detail from that photograph, and you might laugh, but it stuck with me. The mother and the, like, maybe 12-year-old daughter have sandals on that look almost exactly the same. And it made me think, well, this was one trip to town in the spring to get your summer sandals, and we found these and they work, and this is what you're going to wear when a photographer comes to take your picture in your Sunday best.
That's a great observation, Chris, because in fact, the Means family lived on the Y6 Ranch, which is, I think, Debbie, one of the daughters, told me, is 160 miles from the closest really big market town where they would go for orthodontist appointments or to go to a shopping mall. And even Alpine, where the Y6 Ranch is in Jeff Davis County, and even Alpine, I think, is like 90 miles away. And so, yes, exactly. They would have made one trip, and they would have gone into one store, and those sandals work for me, and they're going to work for you. And that's a charming observation, and one that I never thought of myself, but that's exactly right. And another thing that I found that was so moving to me about the women on the ranch was that they always were very close to one another, the grandmother, the daughters-in-law, the grandchildren. And I think it's because the isolation in which they live and spend all day, every day, that they rely on each other much more. They're much more open and talkative to one another, perhaps, than children and grandparents who live in major cities where each generation has their own set of daily activities, and there isn't quite that same interconnection that there is in the isolation, in the enclosed world of a ranch.
When you first started visiting ranches and looking at the work of cowboys and vaqueros, were you surprised at how sort of classical the images are? You didn't stage these, and yet they look like what we imagine when we think about the work of a cowboy.
I was just looking at the book before we began this interview, and I was thinking about the Means, Alf Means, the father, and the vaquero that's with him in the book, and then the son, Bodie Means, and the vaquero with whom he is on horseback and facing the camera. They are kind of classic, great cowboy images, and they're today. And I think the cowboy especially has a sense, I don't mean just these men, but in Montana, in Nevada, in California, they have a cowboy has a sense of his past and his heritage, and they proudly wear it in their dress and also in their manners and, of course, in their way of life, all of which is being diminished as we speak with the high cost of land and all of the encroachment of urban life on ranch land.
So one might assume that ranchers are isolated and they're comfortable with that isolation. It's the work that they love. They love the topography. They're providing a service. There are other people who are isolated by circumstances beyond their control. You've spent a lot of time on the border photographing people who are tracking down illegal migrants and those migrants before and after they're arrested. Talk about trying to get a complete picture of what was happening. And I feel like you're not taking sides here, and yet there's definitely a power imbalance.
The border is completely fascinating to me. I have been working along the border for over 25 years, and it's changed. It's changed a lot. When I began working 25 or 30 years ago, one would cross, people would cross easily back and forth for work, for pleasure, for sightseeing, for caring for. Well, there were Texas churches which would cross over into Mexico and help orphanages. There was all sorts of back and forth. This was, I began in Laredo and Nuevo Laredo. It's completely changed now. Many people I knew on both sides of the border have left because it's so dangerous. And of course, what's happened, we all know now, it's the drug cartels have wreaked havoc along the border and in northern Mexico. And so I do think there have been a lot of big, big changes, sadly, for people along the border.
When you photographed some migrants who had been detained, I guess, by Border Patrol, do you ask their permission before you take their photograph, or is it a different set of circumstances?
I always ask permission before. I never photograph someone without the person knowing I'm taking the picture. So if I'm not, if the distance is too great, for instance, and I can't ask the person, or by language in this case, I can't say, may I take your picture? I always, through emotion, would hold up the camera and nod to the person and let the person know that I am going to take the picture. I just think that's out of respect for the person, and I have always operated that way. I never, sneak isn't a very good word, but I would never do that. So yes, I always ask permission, and if it isn't actually verbal, it's just it's eye contact, and people are generally very open to be photographed.
Another picture I love in the book that's also in the exhibition is of a little girl in a colonia. And for people who don't know, a colonia is a border town, that a little like a little village, but it's informal. Most people don't own the land. There's no plumbing, no lights, no heating. Very, very poor. There's a little girl about 7 years old, and then behind her in the doorway is, I guess, dad and an infant sibling. And she is, boy, she's just glaring at the camera with this kind of, I don't know if it's a resignation or irritation. It's almost like she can see, just as we're imagining her future, she can see her future, and she knows it's not going to be easy.
I think that's exactly right, Chris. In fact, what struck me about her when she was only maybe 7 or 8 years old, and she had such a presence and such a kind of power for a young child, and the way she's looking at the camera, her strength, and her a slight irritation, it made me wary. I mean, I wasn't lightly taking her picture, snapping away. I was very aware of how she was interacting with me. And I do think, I often look at a picture. I mean, anyone does, I think. You look at a photograph and you think, oh, I wonder what's happened to that person. And particularly that photograph, I wonder, because life is so hard along the border in many cases, and particularly, obviously, in a colonia where there's such poverty and no medical attention, no water in some cases, no flowing water in some cases, sewerage. So imagine what her life has been like. And then the father in the background, who looks so kind of ineffectual.
Yeah.
And I felt that she was the grown-up in the, certainly in the picture, she's the grown-up. And
let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is photographer Laura Wilson. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with photographer Laura Wilson. She has a new book out called That Day, Pictures in the American West. And there's an exhibition, That Day, Laura Wilson, at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art up through February 14th of 2016. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. And before we hit that break, Laura, you were talking about just the deprivations of life on the border. Particularly for a child, are not easy to bear.
There's a great quote by Graham Greene that I'll read to you, and I think this captures what I feel and what I've always felt about the border. Graham Greene said, the English novelist said, "How can life on the border be other than reckless? You are pulled by different ties of love and hate." And I think that's been for hundreds and hundreds of years. But right now, it seems even more difficult, life on the border, because of the passage of drugs. I was talking to a man yesterday who is going to Monterey tomorrow, and I said, "Oh, will you go down through?" And I said the route that I would have thought he would have gone. He said, no, it's too dangerous. I'm avoiding Reynosa." So that, and this happens weekly, certainly monthly, that you might go one route 1 week and another route another week because of the shifting conditions along the border. And it's a lot of danger.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. You photograph a lot of, I don't want to say normal people, but regular people. You also have some people who are quite famous in this book and photographed over the years. Here we see Donald Judd and Harry Dean Stanton and Jimmy Dale Gilmore and, of course, Richard Avedon. When your subjects are pros and they're used to being followed around by cameras, do you actually have to work harder to get beyond that facade? Because they know how to take a good photograph, and that's not necessarily, you're not necessarily interested in just getting them looking their most handsome or beautiful.
It depends on the person. They certainly know the look to give the camera, and that's one of the reasons they're very good at what they do. If in fact, they're actors, public figures. The hardest thing almost is getting access to them in the first place, because none of them need to be photographed. All the people that I've photographed, Donald Judd, Ed Ruscha, Harry Dean Stanton, Jimmy Dale Gilmore, none of them need to be photographed by me. They all have plenty of attention and have had plenty of publicity. So to get access with them is almost the most difficult part of taking their photograph. Once I do have permission to photograph them, I always find them extremely interesting. They're not just famous for no reason. They're big, and there's a presence about each of them. They may be quiet and humble, as Jimmy Dale Gilmore is, but there is still a presence that makes them a star. And someone like Ed Ruscha, very interesting to be around. And then I particularly, of course, liked Jim Harrison, who is very unusual, a wonderful writer.
What and a face.
What an amazing face. And he didn't edit himself at all for me, which it was a great pleasure to have the real Jim Harrison. And I liked him a lot. And he was fun to photograph. So he was quite different than, say, Ed Ruscha, who has had a lot of attention by being photographed and written about and is more, not wary, but more cautious. And Donald Judd was he was completely suspicious of me the first afternoon I arrived at his place in Marfa. And I thought, ooh, this is going to be a hard go. And it was a hard go. And then I kind of liked his orneriness. And I thought, well, that made me, it was a kind of stimulating challenge, his orneriness. And we got along very well. I had been sent by the London Sunday Times, and it was still in a period of time when magazines like the Sunday Times magazine still had budgets big enough that they could send a photographer for a week someplace. And so I was very, very lucky to photograph Donald Judd in one of the last weeks of his life. And the last week he was ever in Marfa, because we flew out on the same tiny little plane, and he was going up to Missouri to visit his parents, and I was going back to Dallas, and he died within a month after the photographs that I took of him. And so I feel very lucky to have been the last person to have had the opportunity to photograph him, and I liked him very, very much. Imagine the vision that he had to establish an art center in such a remote area. And then, isn't it great that it's in Texas? And isn't it great that it's been preserved and enlarged and become more thriving than it was even when he was still alive?
Do you think Marfa today and its influence is bigger than Judd would have wanted?
No. I one time asked him, he said that each year he would have a party in October for people who were coming to see the art that was on display at the foundation. And he would open the party to the town, everybody in the town, everybody in the area. So that would be on the main street of town, which seemed so great. And so you'd sit on the main street of Marfa and Judd would be there and he played the bagpipes. And so I said to him one time,
I did not know that.
I said, how is it that you play the bagpipes? So what is it about the bagpipes? Because aren't they very difficult to play? And he said, I like bagpipes because it prohibits conversation.
You were also working with Richard Avedon on the last assignment that he ever took. Saw him the morning that he fell ill with a stroke, and said, you need to go to the hospital. And he didn't want to go until he finished his assignment.
It was an unbelievable situation because, Dick was obsessed with work. And wasn't he lucky to work right up until the very end? And he was working on an important project for The New Yorker. It was called Democracy. And he had been commissioned to do a series of pictures just before the election. And he had worked in New York and in Boston for the presidential elections. And he wanted to get out into the rest of the country to see what people were thinking and what was important to them. And so he asked if I would join him. And we went up to Nevada to a gun show. And we then came back down into Texas, and we worked on the Fort Hood Army base in Killeen, and then went down into San Antonio, where we were the first photographers to go into the Burns Center in San Antonio. And he was so so taken aback by what he was seeing, these terribly burned young boys. We didn't see any women, soldiers. We just saw young men, but they were, 19 years old and burned over 60% of their body, and they were, in bandages and couldn't move from the bed. And he was very, very moved by that. And we were to go back the next day and continue photographing when he woke up that morning of the next day, completely disoriented. He had had a series of strokes, I think, in the night, and he was not himself. And so I didn't know what was the matter, but I said, I think we need to go to the hospital. And he said, no, we're not going, and I'm going to keep the appointment. We have it at noontime. And it was both something for me to see someone so committed to what they were doing within their life, what he had always done, photograph, that he would not see any other path to take. And also, touching to see someone so vulnerable, because he had been such an influence on my life and such a strong, dominant force.
For people who don't know the story, in the late 70s, he was looking for an assistant. You had worked in photography, but had not fully established your career. and you decided to write a letter and say, I'll do this thing for you. Was that a crazy proposition? Did you have contacts or connections to him that made that letter something other than a moonshot at the time?
Bob, my husband, was working, had a small advertising and corporate design business. He and Mitch Wilder, the director of the Amon Carter, were very close, and Bob was doing quite a bit of work with the Amon Carter, with Mitch. And Bob, Dick Avedon, was on the cover of Newsweek, and it was a very big occasion to have a photographer on the cover of a major news magazine. And when Bob saw that, he called Mitch Wilder and said, wouldn't it be great if we could get Richard Avedon to do a series of pictures of people in the West, prominent men and women? And so Mitch said, that's a great idea. Go ahead and give him a call. And so because I knew Richard Avedon might get the commission from the Amon Carter Museum, I immediately wrote to, I didn't know him, but I immediately wrote to him and asked if I might work with him on the project. And he called up. I was so startled. I thought it would take weeks for a reply. And he called up and said, yes, let's go out to Sweetwater, to the Rattlesnake Roundup in Sweetwater, Texas, and we'll begin working on this project, which turned out to be a five-year project, a major body of work by Richard Avedon, commissioned by the Amon Carter Museum.
There's a charming picture in the book of a sign that he fell in love with. Was it Montana, Wyoming?
It was in New Mexico.
Oh, okay.
Outside of Gallup, New Mexico. And Dick was great fun to travel with because he was full of enthusiasms, full of opinions. And he was a very good traveler. He didn't need to stay in he didn't care where he stayed, as long as there was direct dial. he didn't like bed and breakfast. But on this particular day, early in the morning, we were driving along. We were going into Gallup. And he saw a sign that was a funeral business sign, a mortuary, and it said Rolly Mortuary. And the Rolleiflex was the great camera of the great photographers after World War II. And Dick had always used a Rolleiflex, which they all called Rollies. And so he hopped out and he made his two assistants hold him up so he could lie prone in front of the Rolly Mortuary, saying, this is exactly where I want to end my days, right here at the Rolly Mortuary.
800-933-5372 is our telephone. My guest is photographer Laura Wilson, who has an exhibition at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art right now through February 14th. Let's go on the phone to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello.
Hi.
I have carried a camera around with me everywhere, mostly in an amateur capacity. My work photos are not like what you're talking about. But there are times when I just kick myself for not taking the photo. In the southern part of Idaho one time at sunset, traveling in the middle of nowhere on the highway with vehicles, watching a cattle drive across an overhead ramp with cowboys and cows. And it was very ironic to have the cars and the cowboys. I didn't take it. I think I had a fussy passenger. I still, 20, 25 years later, wish I'd taken it, but because I had that wish, I remember it very well. Do you have similar situations or photos that you wish you'd taken?
Well, I think your experience is exactly the experience of probably every photographer, and I have them all the time. I can think they still pierce my heart, the photographs that I missed.
The one that got away.
Yes, exactly, Chris. And the thing is, I think you never, now what I say, ignore the fussy passenger. Always take the picture. And don't ever have regrets. Again, always snap the picture, stop the car, hop out, do it. I mean, because you will, as you have experienced 25 years later, still have regrets.
There are images in this book of people that you came to know well because you spent time with them, but you don't have, you know, close family members, for example. And I was thinking about the fact that we all take lots of pictures of the people in our lives, and a lot of those pictures, without meaning to, sort of tell lies. You know, we post, we pose for pictures. One of my favorite photographs is of, it's a picture of my little sister. And in the background, my then teenage sister and my mother were arguing about something, which they did a lot between, you know, 1982 and 1986. And they have a wonderful relationship now. But I love that picture because it's actually a moment that represents what happened a lot. And it's funny. But there's one of those. There's a lot of pictures of people standing up straight and smiling in front of birthday cake.
That's a great observation, Chris, because photography can be the least real experience. Because, for instance, the photograph could have been of one sister and not included your other sister and your mother. And the fact that you have all of them together in the same photograph with the arguing is a great authentic picture, unusual to have.
Is it harder for you to get those kinds of pictures with people that you are really close to? Because you do, you want to capture them completely, but you also love them so much that you see them with maybe a different, with a different heart.
I think that's the responsibility of the concerned photographer, that you absolutely should think with your heart, because you can easily make fun of people. You can easily photograph someone looking very vulnerable. So it's a very big responsibility for a photographer to be respectful of the subject. And by that I don't mean not authentic, but you do have to think about, because just as we were talking earlier, the photograph lasts forever. And so but I do feel it's like a journalist. For instance, if you present yourself one way and you get access to a situation, an event, an experience, but in fact you're covering up your real intent. I have great questions about that. I mean, that's done a lot, and it's done a lot in photography, and it's done a lot in writing. But I think that I feel very responsible, and so I always want to be careful about that kind of image.
My guest is photographer Laura Wilson. Her new book is That Day, Pictures in the American West. You can see an exhibition of her work at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art called That Day, Laura Wilson. It is up until February 14th of 2016. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with photographer Laura Wilson. The exhibition That Day, Laura Wilson, is at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art through February 14th. There's also a new book out called That Day, Pictures in the American West. Laura, you were saying that you are careful and respectful and somewhat protective of your subjects, and yet not every picture in this book makes every person look beautiful or kind or intelligent?
I think you have a responsibility. The photographer also has a responsibility to the work. So it's a conflict, isn't it? Because people don't really know how they're going to look in once the photograph is taken, or once the photographer is pushing for a certain look and pursuing a certain look, I should say. For instance, in the series of pictures I did of Jim Harrison, I'm not sure Jim Harrison is going to like his photograph. Nevertheless, I think it's a very strong, powerful picture, and I think it reveals a lot about the creative, or it could reveal a lot about the creative spirit. So in that case, I don't know. In other times, people who understand a bit more about writing or photography, even if they don't look the way you and I might want to look in front of the camera, our understanding of the image. And so that's a very big relief. It's a complicated subject, a complicated discussion we're having right now, because it's important for the photographer to have a sense of responsibility to both the subject and to one's own work. The purpose of a portrait. And the purpose of a portrait isn't to please, necessarily. Mm-hmm. The purpose of a portrait is to have strength and complexity and something of lasting interest, something that could maybe hold the wall if it's up on the wall.
Do you feel comfortable being photographed?
No.
Why not?
It's an invasion.
Do you overthink the whole what's happening?
Yes. Yes. I'm not a good subject.
Have you done self-portraiture at all?
No, I never have. I was thinking, though, when I was actually majored in painting in college and in drawing, and for my senior thesis, I did it. I suppose we all had, and would never have chosen to do this. I suppose we were all assigned to do a self-portrait, and I did a drawing, and I think now I didn't keep it, but as I remember it, it was quite a harsh, sharp look at myself, and I think maybe was within me what interests me now in photography. It isn't the pleasant, easy portrait, but the one that has resonance by very nature of its complexity and difficulty in looking at it.
When you are photographing a person, you very much ground them in their surroundings, and you give us a lot to look at in the things that populate their world. Wealthier people have the power to conceal or reveal only exactly what they want to conceal or reveal, whereas people of more limited means have to sort of live with what they have. Does that affect the way that you approach a subject in his or her environment?
Well, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because, again, it's the power, when one is photographing, the power lies with the photographer. So I can choose what to include in the photograph. So the person of wealth or power or privilege, what have I chosen to reveal about where they live, where they work, how they spend their days? I think the power is always with the photographer, and you can do a portrait in such a way to present it, to reinforce perhaps what one feels about the person.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Joshua in Arlington. Hi, Joshua.
Hello. I'm glad that the discussion has moved to one of the ethics of working with human subjects. And I think Ms. Wilson's more wealthy human subjects knew. They had informed consent. She'd received informed consent in the sense that they knew what would be done with the pictures. They know that, Ms. Wilson, that you're going to be making a living off of that. But I'm not so sure that your poorer human subjects along the U.S.-Mexico border had that sense. Did they really give their informed consent? Did they know that you were going to be making money off of the images?
Well, I don't make a living off photographing people, and I don't really make any money off these pictures. That said, I always have a person's permission when I'm photographing them. They generally can see me. Obviously, they can see me. I can see them. They can see me. They know what I'm doing. I often have to have a legal release. And so I don't just snap pictures. And I'm very respectful of a person, no matter what his or her background is.
You went to places where people were staging dogfights and cockfights. I have to imagine that people with your bearing do not walk into these events very often. Did you have to, you know, were you almost playing a character to walk in there and allow yourself to gain access, or how did that work?
Again, I had to ask permission, and sometimes I was denied, and other times it was agreed that I could photograph. So but that's, again, very difficult, and I might not. I mean, those were taken in the 1990s, and today I might not be allowed to take those pictures.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going, Chris?
Very well, thanks.
Hey, I was wondering if Laura had a preference in black and white and color, and does she prefer a digital camera or the film camera? I just feel like black and white gives you so much more feeling.
Thanks so much for your call.
I like both black and white and color. I began in black and white, and this book is almost entirely in black and white. When I say I began my career in photography in black and white. But now color interests me a great deal, and I do more and more in color. I use a digital camera. Actually, I'm doing more and more in color now because of a digital camera. I just switched to digital 2 years ago, and one now can manipulate the color in digital photography in a way it wasn't possible to manipulate with traditional color processing and color development, color printing. So I'm interested in color in a way because I like the way you can sort of desaturate the colors and remove color so it isn't garish. And well, I sometimes think color is vulgar, and I try and quiet the color down, and it's possible to do that now in digital photography. And then another thing about digital photography is the great pleasure of passing through metal detectors or whatever the scanners in an airport, where I used to carry 60, 80 rolls, 100 rolls of film to do a job someplace. And I would be always stuck opening every canister. And the more remote and less likely a terrorist would be in the airport, the more obsessed with strictness the guards would be. So I must say I am so happy when I sail through the security now in an airport with just a couple of digital cameras.
So I have to say, you might be, I've interviewed a fair number of professional photographers. You might have had the latest conversion of anyone that I've interviewed. What was it, like a 5-year decoupling from really loving your film camera, or what finally convinced you to make the switch?
I think that's right, Chris. I probably am the last person to, certainly the last person I knew of to switch. I switched overnight. And one reason I think I switch, I have a very good assistant, and oftentimes we'll be working together. He said, oh, you'll never be able to do this. You won't even be able to cope with this digital camera. And I was so kind of irritated by his lack of confidence in me that I switched overnight, and it's fantastic.
Do you take pictures on, like, your iPhone?
Yes, yeah. They're not very good. Other people's pictures are a lot better on their iPhone. I haven't mastered the iPhone.
What do you pull out your phone and just snap a picture of?
I take a picture if I'm someplace and I want to check locations, check the light, often friends, people, my own family. But I love the idea of, because for me to really have the picture and have it in my possession, the iPhone it seems much more ephemeral to me. So I guess that's one reason why I haven't mastered it, because I wonder, oh, how am I going to get these pictures out of this little device?
how the pictures in the exhibition are pretty large, right?
Yes, they are. They're some are 60 or 70 inches wide, very big, and 35 millimeter film that has been blown up to this very, very large size. And I don't care about grain or sometimes even focus doesn't interest me. What interests me is the content of a picture, the meaning of a photograph, and the strength of the photograph comes from the content and the meaning. It doesn't come from, if it's sharp, it doesn't matter to me. So I'm interested in pictures that, well, for instance, if you take the great photographs of Robert Capa that he took as they were landing in Normandy and on D-Day, there the film must have gotten wet, it is out of focus, and they're the most powerful images you could have of war.
Before I went carefully through this book from beginning to end, I was sort of flipping through it, and sometimes I'll go backwards, and I came upon this amazing photograph of someone being thrown from a horse. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing, that you had been that close, that you'd been ready with the camera. And then I flipped forward a couple of pages and realized that it was a stunt rider. But it's still amazing to see something like that up close.
It was amazing to photograph it. The stunt cowboy is one of the last, maybe there are only maybe five or at the most eight stunt cowboys that still can do this kind of thing. And he said to me that no matter what kind of motorcycles, no matter what kind of cars, no matter what kind of fires, no matter what kind of stunts you do, you can't call yourself a real stuntman unless you can do stunt work on a horse. And he is the best in the business. He's worked on every Western from the last 25 years. And he did this stunt so that I might photograph him. And he had dug a pit for the horse. So when the horse fell, he was falling into soft ground. And it was what's called a green horse. So that a horse, once he gets has fallen several times, or maybe a few more than several times, they get so that they won't fall, obviously. Mm-hmm. They can keep their balance. And so I was very lucky to get those pictures. And yes, it was, well, I mean, imagine a person who's, what, 140, 170 pounds being fallen on by something that's 1,500 pounds.
And I would imagine, you know, he's not going to do this for you all day, right? So you had how long was the preparation and you figuring out where this would happen and where the fall would take place and sort of getting ready? And then I guess the whole thing was over in a matter of a few seconds.
Yes, exactly. So I had, Richard prepared the ground for probably all morning, half a day. And then it was over in maybe 10 seconds. I had two tries. Two falls of the horse. And what interested me in the first place...
Let's take a drink of water. We got a second here. We're speaking with photographer Laura Wilson.
What interested me in the first place is the fact that as a child growing up, I had seen all of these Western movies where horses come galloping at the camera, ridden by Indians, ridden by cavalry, ridden by cowboys, and these amazing stunts. And I thought, how do they do? How would they do that? And so when I actually was on a couple of movies and saw them doing it, I was interested in photographing it.
That takes care of our time. Laura Wilson is my guest. She's a photographer. Her new book is called That Day, Pictures in the American West. The exhibition That Day, Laura Wilson is at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art through February 14th of 2016. Laura, it is always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.